Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, everybody. Can anybody hear me out there? 1, 2, 3. Anybody hear me? Audio. So we have got real problems here. Can anybody hear me? No sound. Do we have sound now? All right. So it sounds like the sound is working. For some reason, Blog Talk Radio, as usual, screwed me over. All right. Here we are. Today's an exciting show. I'm really looking forward to. We've got Adam Mossoff, really one of the world leading experts on the issue of intellectual property rights. I know you guys, listeners to the show and others, have for months been saying, hey, you know, we need a show on intellectual property rights. I know there are a lot of libertarians out there and a lot of objectivists who are confused about the issue of intellectual property rights. So hopefully we can clarify a lot of that up. Let's see if I can get Adam on the line. Hey, Adam, is that you?
Yes, I'm on the line. You're on.
All right, great. Yes, I can. Yes, I can.
Excellent.
Yeah, great. Thanks for joining us today. And apologize for the technical difficulties in the beginning there. It's Blog Talk Radio, and we just live with them. All right.
No problem.
So let me give a quick intro to Adam for those of you not familiar with, and I know there are a lot of people going to listen to this not live who are probably even less. But, you know, Adam's a professor of law at the Scalia Law School. I guess it was just renamed after Scalia at George Mason University. He's the director of academic programs and senior scholar at the Center for the Protection of Intellectual Property at George Mason, which is a center that you, Adam, founded, right? Co-founded in about 4 years ago.
Yes, correct.
So Adam teaches rights in the areas of patent law, trade secrets, trademark law, property law, and internet law. He's published extensively, and I'm not going to read the whole list of publications on the history, some fascinating stuff on the history of patents and the history of intellectual property rights and the theory of all those. He's also testified before the Senate and the House of Representatives on patent legislation, has filled numerous amicus briefs in intellectual property cases, and is a regular speaker at congressional staff briefings and academic conferences. I think you spoke in some of ARI's congressional briefings, right, for on IP.
Yes, correct.
And Adam's also written on these issues for the New York Times, Forbes, Slate, The Hill, Investors Business Daily, and many, many other publications. And importantly, I've known Adam. It's scary, Adam.
Yes.
for over 20 years. Adam was a member of the founding class of the Objectivist Graduate Center, which was the precursor of the Objectivist Academic Center, and which I was kind of a part-time member. I kind of drifted in and out of the OGC, but Adam and I were pretty much in the same class, or at least overlapped on some of the classes. And Adam's been a frequent speaker at Objectivist conferences since the 1990s, so those are the credentials. It's pretty impressive, and it's a real pleasure to have you on. Thanks for joining us, Adam.
Well, thank you, Your Honor. It's a real delight to be here.
Good. All right. So there's a lot of controversy around intellectual property rights, particularly in kind of the the libertarian world, and I think a lot of, as a consequence, a lot of objectivists are confused about the issue because the libertarians raise this often, and it's you know, we're often in the same kind of circles as many of the libertarians. So why don't we start with just the basics? You know, what is intellectual property rights? Can property be intellectual? What does that even mean? So what's the kind of the philosophical foundation here of intellectual property rights?
Sure, Yaron, that's a great question. It kind of gets at the core, one of the core issues. But I'd like to just say as a preliminary matter that, I mean, one of the problems with the kind of the theoretical explanation for why intellectual property, of course, is property, is that there is a lot of confusion about the history, a lot of confusions about the law, a lot of arguments from anecdotes about, oh, I heard such and such case and things of that sort. So, and a lot of that, I think, feeds some misunderstandings of the theoretical explanation and prevents people from really grappling with and understanding the power of the theoretical explanation that really Ayn Rand came up with, and you know, it's part of her kind of radical approach to thinking, both in methodology and content. But at root, I mean, the reason why we call intellectual property intellectual property is, in part, it is distinguished from other types of property. So it's a type of property, and it's a type of property that is distinct from property rights in land and in chattels and in water and in air and in all the other types of material values of which people have legitimate property rights in the sense that they are creating values in those things. It is property rights in a subset of things, inventions, which are covered by patents, writings and songs and other creative works, which are covered by copyright, corporate goodwill as reflected in logos, which is covered by trademark, industrial processes and other types of commercially valuable information that's created by companies that's covered by trade secret insofar as kept secret. And so that's kind of your core set of intellectual property rights. And it's called intellectual property rights because these are the set of property rights that really get at the core foundation of where property comes from, which is the fact that all material values ultimately are rooted in the man's rational capacity to look out into the world, to, you know, think about what we need to survive and to have flourishing lives, and then to proceed to create those values.
So why do you think people have such a hard time with this concept? Because sure, they've heard particularly concretes, they've heard particularly legal things, but it strikes me that there's a fundamental kind of epistemological barrier that people have to understanding, because they kind of get that it's my house, it's my land, but they seem to not get that it's my idea and that the idea of my idea requires legal protection. Why do you think this is so complicated when it shouldn't be?
well, I think there's lots of reasons that yeah. lead people to not understanding why intellectual property is just another type of property. And some of them, as I mentioned, come from kind of improper theoretical starting points in the sense that they start from they use economics as their foundation for understanding property instead of moral theory and thinking about what are the facts of human nature that require humans to create property and therefore why we have property rights. And so they start from concepts like scarcity and things of that sort. Another kind of basic issue is that it is a complex issue. I mean, Ayn Rand even acknowledges in her very short essay that's just 2.5 pages on patents and copyrights and capitalism and ideal that, you know, that these are complex issues. Because it is a type of property right that arises much later when you have it's part and parcel of creating a capitalist society, moving forward in terms of our technological progression or our legal recognition of certain things, having a government that can protect those types of issues. So, I think a lot of people see it. At least as kind of a derivative form or not real property because you start with you know, they think you start with, you know, property rights and land and in personal goods and animals and things of that sort. And then it's later we have this kind of come up with this more complex notion, and they think that because it's later, it's somehow artificial or special or derivative and not really property. But that's a real basic error in thinking, right? Because, you know, yep. There's lots of things that come later. Most things in our advanced society today have come later that are very important and fundamental, and doesn't mean that they're derivative and problematic, like, for instance, corporations, right? And this is something I think you're very familiar with in your
yep.
background in business and finance.
Yeah, of course.
Corporations
of course,
did not come
have problems
into...
They have problems with those as well. Libertarians have
yeah.
problems with those as well.
Yeah.
For similar reasons, I think.
Yeah. Yes. Exactly. I think, and I think for very similar reasons, because they think of these things as it involves two things. It involves, once you go to kind of a higher level of abstraction and complexity with human interactions as they develop through a free market and through a free political system that we had in the United States, you know, if you have kind of a fundamental mistakes in your methodology, or if you made a basic mistake in substance in terms of, you know, what choosing which are your basic foundational starting points, they'll become amplified and it becomes more difficult to understand at a higher level of thinking. And also it ties into the fact that these more abstract notions like corporations and credit and all these other types of intangible type of interests that we have, property interests in advanced capitalist societies, require government. You know, and I think, you know, for some libertarians, you know, whose basic premise is anarchism and that government is the problem, and they want to get away from government, then any institution, even proper institution like a corporation or intellectual property right, that requires government to enforce it, they would be viewed, they would assume as invalid.
Don't you also think that some of them are, and I've noticed this among libertarians, certainly among some leftists, that they are epistemologically materialists, that they really cannot conceive and cannot give credit to anything abstract. Abstraction are not real in some sense to them. They're floating by definition, and therefore they you know, property rights are okay when it's something physical that they can touch and they can feel, because everything is a product of the physical reality. But as soon as you get to any kind of abstract concept like credit, like corporations, and certainly like intellectual property rights, they just fall apart.
Right, and you know, and it's a great point that you just made, because this is something that in our very first year of law school, in the basic property course, where we're teaching property rights and land and things of that sort, one of the very first points that we drill into our students from the get-go is that property is not the thing, not the tangible thing. That's a conceptual layer, and law students get this right away when we teach it to them. Your property is itself an abstraction. It's a moral concept, mm-hmm. and property rights are simply the rights that to control and use something in society, and that something can be anything.
Yep.
And it is anything. So, in fact, it was one of the achievements of the British common law and later the American law that grew out of the British common law that they recognized this point. And so, in fact, one of the historical myths that is perpetuated by libertarians is that, you know, there's no such thing as intellectual property until legislatures captured by monopolies legislatures captured by lobbying special interests, you know, created these monopolies through statutes. And that's actually not true. The courts, long before the United States even came into existence in England, had a concept. They called it intangible hereditaments or incorporeal property. And that referred to the rights of property, the rights of use and disposition and things of that sort that you could transfer to people because you could separate that from the thing.
Yep. So, Adam, are you okay with taking some calls?
Oh, certainly.
Yeah, let's see. We've got somebody here, 302 area code. Who's this?
This is Skylar calling from Delaware.
Hey, Skylar, how you doing?
Doing well, sir. How are you?
Good, good. You're on the line with Adam Ossoff and myself. You got a question about IP?
Yes.
Go for it.
In the film The Social Network, Mark Zuckerberg, defending his website, says, A guy who builds a nice chair doesn't owe money to everyone who's ever built a chair. So whether it's chairs or websites, what is it that makes someone truly own property?
Adam?
I'm having a little trouble understanding exactly what you're trying to get at. I mean, property is the right to control and dispose of a material value. Now you may have that right because you created that material value, which is what intellectual property secures to creators and inventors and artists and other types of innovators. Or you may have that right because it was transferred to you by someone who previously had created it. But the ultimate source of property, the ultimate basis of ownership, and ownership is property, is at root a material value had to be created by someone. And then the nature of that material value, whether it's digging a well or whether it's creating a farm using the techniques of husbandry and learning about what plants are can be consumed and which ones can't be by humans and things of that sort, defines the nature of the property interest that you have. So, of course, there are different types of rules, different types of legal rules for different types of property. And, in fact, this is why I spend an entire semester teaching my students property, because the rules for how we define property in land are very different from how we define the material values are created in wild animals or in other types of personal goods, like cars and other types of things people may create, which are very different from the values that you may create in water, and the value you may create in spectrum, and in the air, and so on and so on, all the way up to the values that you create by coming up with a new invention or a new book or a new song.
So, Skylar, does that answer your question, or
yes, that was
you want to elaborate a little bit? Good.
That was thorough and clear. That's what I needed. I just needed a quicker understanding of the relationship of you creating out of the physical realm of the given and taking it and using your mind to make a product. That was
right.
That was clear. Thank you.
Excellent. Thanks, Skylar. Thanks for calling.
Thank you, gentlemen. Take care.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Let's see. We got a bunch of callers, Adam, so we're going to take them in order. Hi, are you on the Yvonne Brooks Show? This is area code 808. Who's this?
Aloha. It's Stuart.
Aloha, Stuart. How's it going?
Hi.
All my regulars are calling, Adam.
Great. Hello, Stuart.
Hi. So my question is, well, this is what a Rothbardian always told me, well, many of them. They always say, if you have a patent, it gives you a government-enforced monopoly on a whole general category of product, a whole vague general idea. Now, is that what a patent is?
Again, this gets to some of the misunderstandings of the law, and how people who have very fuzzy notions of what exactly a patent is grapple on to these misunderstandings, and then it leads them to make further errors in their thinking about what exactly is that we're securing. A patent secures an invention, the invention that a piece of technology, and technology can be also abstract because it's technology to come up with a new process, for instance, a new industrial process or a process for making a molecule that's used in a medical treatment. That is what the patent secures to you. Now, what patents also secure to you is that invention as distinguished from superficial changes to it as well. So, for instance, it was recognized very early on, very early in the 19th century, people read patents and then said, oh, well, this person got a patent on a railway car shaped in a canonical shape. I'll make a hexagon, the exact same railway car that performs the exact same function of carrying coal, but mine won't be a cone, mine will be a hexagon. So it's different. And the courts rightly recognize that whether it's a hexagon or a cone, that's a mere superficial change that doesn't get to the essence of what the nature of the invention is and the value in it is. And that's what they're really trying to secure with the property right in the invention through the patent. And of course, you know, sometimes there's some dispute as to, well, what really is a superficial change and what is a copying of the core characteristics of what makes this an invention. But at root, what you have protected is the invention that you have to, the law requires you to describe it very clearly in your invention, in your patent. And if you don't, the patent will be invalidated for being unclear. And by the way, there's very similar types of so-called fuzziness on the margins, even with land and other types of property interests, because again, what the property is not securing is the material thing. What the property right refers to is the value in that thing. And that value can be interfered with even when you don't have an immediate physical breach of it. So, for instance, someone doesn't have to jump your fence to violate your property rights. They can actually interfere with your property rights by preventing you from using your property as you are trying to use it in a way that is not infringing anyone else's property right. you know, so for instance, you know, you maybe are using your property to capture ducks, and your neighbor decides, well, I don't like that, you know, I don't like you, and so I'm going to start shooting off guns right on my property, right next to your property, for the sole purpose of disrupting your ability to continue collecting ducks on your property. The courts very early on recognized that that's an actual case that I teach to my students from the 18th century. The courts recognized that is an interference with the right of use and disposition of property, and it should be stopped. And in that instance, you didn't have actually a physical breach of the property interest. You know, the person shooting the gun didn't jump the fence and trespass, and yet he was deliberately interfering with the use of the property.
So would that also be a basis, Adam, for things like you know, pollution in a sense that, yeah, you're not physically breaching my property, but the stuff that you're doing in your backyard is affecting the quality of my life?
Oh, yes, exactly. And in fact, this is a doctrine known as nuisance in property law.
Okay.
And nuisance is distinguished from trespass in the sense that it is not an immediate kind of physical breach of your property rights. It's an interference with the right of use of your property, and this was exactly the doctrine that was used to address things like pollution and other types of related concerns. And it was the argument that this isn't good enough, which is what the
yep.
progressives and other leftists used to justify the regulatory state and creating things like environmental controls.
Yep.
Yes.
Stuart, I do want to address one thing you said. I mean, because just the way you phrase it, or the way you said that the kind of the libertarian or the Rothbardians phrase it, governments don't actually grant you a patent or copyright any more than they grant you a property right, right? Their job
exactly.
is not to grant, it's to protect.
It's
so the
here.
Right
mm-hmm.
to the right to an invention, the right to a drug, the right to technological invention is not something that is granted by the government. It is something that you have by the very fact that you have invented it, that you have made that, you know, that you've achieved something. And then if you file it, then the government's job is then to protect it. It's not, again, so it's not the granting of, and this is where libertarians like to say it's the granting of and give government kind of as if government is creating rights.
Right.
And government doesn't create rights. Go ahead, Adam.
Exactly. From the get-go in the United States, because the United States was an innovator itself, not just kind of in the structure of our political government and things of that sort, but of course it innovated with respect to intellectual property rights. We were the very first country to recognize that these were not special grants or privilege, that these were property rights that were secured to creators in the same way that the government secures a farm to the person who goes out onto fallow, unowned land and starts to till the soil and creates a value there. And that securing of that property right in the farm is called a title deed, and patents from the get-go in the United States were called title deeds. They were recognized as being tantamount, legally equivalent to the exact same thing. It is a recognition and a security, legal security in the creator's moral right to the thing that they've created, the value that they've created.
Stuart, does that answer your question?
Well, they told me this morality tale, which sounds kind of fishy to me. They say Alexander Graham Bell and Elisha Gray filed for our patents on the exact same invention on the exact same day, and the patent went to Alexander Graham Bell and not Elisha Gray. Therefore, Alexander Graham Bell does have a government-enforced monopoly. He stole rightful control over the telephone from Elisha Gray. But what's the story behind that?
Well, again, this is what I got. These are the types of things that I was referring to earlier about. There are, you know, stories and anecdotes and myths that are created, and people argue from them instead of trying to think clearly in terms of principle and think in terms of what are our basic premises and what's the core evidence. They latch on to a particular story or particular anecdote. There was a dispute between Elisha Gray and Alexander Graham Bell as to who was the first to invent the telephone. It wasn't an issue of who filed first, because at that time and up until 2011, the United States was what we call a first-to-invent country. So this is part of our recognizing property rights in inventions and in creative works, because we secured it only to the first inventor. And there was a dispute, and there was a legal process. It used to be called an interference action at the patent office, where the job of that legal process is to adjudicate the dispute between two people who filed for a patent application on the exact same invention, which one was actually first. And it was determined through objective rules of evidence and all the other types of processes that we use in court systems to adjudicate all the types of similar types of disputes, including similar disputes as to land and to personal goods, as to who's the first owner of it, that Alexander Graham Bell was actually the person who first conceived of and reduced into practice this technology that we now identify as the telephone.
Great. Great answer, Adam. Thanks, Stuart. Appreciate your call. We've got
Mahalo.
A lineup. I don't know Hawaiian, Stuart. I mean, you confuse me when you do that. But that's it. Walo? No, I don't know if I'm pronouncing it right. All right. We got another caller, 4-7. Hi, you're on the Yaron Brook Show. Who's this?
Hello, this is Lori. I'm listening and learning and enjoying your show. Something came to mind when you were speaking, and that is unfair use. There's a lot of us freelance writers who pay our dues, which is nothing but BS. It's just basically giving people a lot of free stuff until finally somebody wants to pay for something more private and a little bit more. Unfair use has been a problem for me, because even whenever I go on reputable magazine forums, my full work, including my name, gets posted on these little freebie blogspot sites. And unfortunately, these international, and I don't know international law how to deal with this, but these Russian and these Filipino sites, and they add porn to what I've written. And I've written things on very reputable sites, and I know that's unfair use. And I've even seen my intellectual property being used on a Target commercial. I don't know how to stop it. I don't know how to get paid for what I write. Obviously, it's good if it's getting around and things like that are happening to it. And I just want to know, in the U.S., you know, I've contacted the FBI. I've contacted everybody. People pretty much just laugh at me.
Well, I mean, so in terms of your the plight you're describing is a plight that is suffered by almost all creators today and artists. You know, in fact, an aphorism that I've heard, you know, used in creative industries is that you know, the effective term of copyright now is about 30 seconds, because that's how long it takes for someone to take your song or your writing and post it on the internet, and then people copy it and gets displaced all over, and then it gets transferred overseas and things of that sort, and the genie's out of the bottle, and it's very hard to stop that. And the U.S. has not created the legal protections on the internet that they should create for creators and artists in this respect. So yeah, I completely understand and empathize with your plight, because it's one that is really a problem for many creators today. And there are resources out there that are harder to find, but there are resources for the independent artists. In fact, there's an entire trade association called the Copyright Alliance in Washington, D.C., whose job is to represent the interests of individual artists, and they have facts on their website, frequent asked questions, resources, and things of that sort for assisting you with these types of questions and issues that you have. And I'd recommend just checking out the Copyright Alliance's website.
Okay, thanks, Laurie. This actually brings up, Adam, the international aspect of this brings up a question that comes up on the show frequently because I am a big defender of trade with China, and not all of my listeners are sympathetic to that point of view. Mm-hmm. But the best argument I hear about, and particularly with Donald Trump and everything going on, but the best argument I hear about against trade with China is the argument that, look, Chinese companies steal intellectual property rights. Shouldn't we be penalizing them in some way? Mm-hmm. So what are your thoughts, A, about what is the reality of intellectual property rights today with China? It seems like there's been some improvement. And second, what do you think and this is maybe goes beyond your scope of expertise, but then what the hell? What do you think that a free country should do foreign policy wise to a country where intellectual property rights are clearly being violated? What should be the appropriate response?
Oh, those are great questions. And so, the situation in China today is radically different from what it was 15 or 20 years ago, or even especially 30 or 40 years ago, with respect to intellectual property. I was, in fact, part of a delegation that went to Beijing last fall to meet with Chinese officials, in particular judges. One of their judges on the Supreme People's Court, who's in charge of the intellectual property, and chief judge of the Beijing Intellectual Property Court, to talk with them about intellectual property issues. Because the fact of the matter is that China recently has at least in legal terms, has caught the intellectual property bug, so to speak. China, as Yaron, as you probably know, it's one of the BRICS countries, the Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa. So it's a set of five countries that's in between the G20 and the other developing worlds. And these BRICS countries right now are trying to figure out how to become the G20. And so a lot of them are kind of looking at, historically, what have the G20 done and had as part of their legal systems. And China looked at us and said, well, one of the things the United States has long had is a very strong patent system, and so they have, and a strong copyright system, and so they have in the past 5 or 10 years proceeded to implement an extensive intellectual property system. There's a Chinese patent office. They're actually issuing more patents right now than the United States is. They created special intellectual property courts. They are promoting their people to invent and to create works and to file patents. And so the conversations that we are now having with China as a country and also individual companies that are having with China are very different than they were 15 or 20 years ago. 50 or 20 years ago it was entirely how you characterized it. It was you're copying our stuff, that needs to stop. Now it's actually, in some respects, they actually have in some areas better IP protections than we have in the United States.
So does that apply internationally as well? That is, I can get that they kind of respect other, the property rights, intellectual property rights of the Chinese, but there's still this impression, at least, that they're happy to, Chinese companies can steal American ideas, and the Chinese government will do nothing about that. So the American companies are still wary, I guess, of heading over there. Do you still see that, or they have been getting better at that as well?
Well, this has always been a problem. So intellectual property laws are always what in the law we say are domestic. So, for instance, U.S. intellectual property laws only apply within the United States, but that's not unusual to us. English property laws only apply within the domain of Great Britain, and France's intellectual property laws only apply within the domain of France. And so what you're describing is has been a problem, and a particular problem since globalization, the rise of globalization in the past 30 years, with all countries, you know, taking advantage of the fact that United States set up U.S. Companies set up manufacturing facilities and other things in other countries, and then those people in those other countries steal our ideas. And China was particularly bad about it for a while, and they continue to be bad. I don't want to suggest that this problem doesn't still exist, in, you know, to some degree, because it does. And it is a problem. Continues. It's just that I was trying to suggest or talking about the fact that China is taking steps. Right, it's not a problem that they're going to solve overnight, but the Chinese government is just trying to start to take steps, and move their intellectual property system in a direction that is positive. But it is still a problem, and it's a very thorny problem, because it's difficult, because you don't, as a country, exercise influence over another country, aside from
are there treaties to deal with this?
There are treaties, and in fact, there is an extensive international network of treaties that specifically deal with intellectual property. In this attempt to at least originally among what are called the G20, the most developed countries, to harmonize our intellectual property protection. And other countries are slowly signing on to these treaties as they recognize the importance of protecting intellectual property, because actually one of the reasons why countries are starting to come around and to recognize that intellectual property is important is not, you know, especially these are countries that are not necessarily country dedicated to protecting the rights of life, liberty, and property, is because there's actually an extensive amount of economic studies that have been done. They've shown positive correlations, extensive positive correlations, between intellectual property protections, especially patent protections, and economic development, positive trade flows, foreign investment, and things of that sort. And so countries that just want to develop economically and expand economically have recognized that, oh, well, we should have patent protections. But it's it is a problem.
Sure. So what about the argument, the kind of utilitarian economic argument that is often made, that patents hinder innovation because they, you know, they reduce competition and they discourage basic research and spending on research, that they're inefficient way of diverting resources. So there's a huge literature among, again, mainly libertarians about how this is, you know, both theoretical and I guess they claim empirical, about how, no, patents actually limit options and limit research. They cause drug prices to be very expensive and fewer, you know, people don't invest in drugs once there's a patent and all this other.
Yeah.
I would say crap, but you know, I'm trying to be objective.
Yeah.
Well, crap is objective, actually. So.
Yes, it does exist. So these complaints, you mentioned, are theoretical and some empirical. Actually, it's largely theoretical, because the complaints are predicated upon mistaken assumptions about what are your starting premises for assessing property right protection and assessing how economic development and a flourishing society arises out of protecting property rights. So for instance, you know, you often hear, oh, well, patents impede the ability of companies to engage in research and development because there's a patent and they can stop that. And in fact, the exact opposite is the case. And the reason why the exact opposite of the case, and most patent lawyers, when they hear that, it's very perplexing to them. And it's, in fact, Supreme Court justices say this, and it's this is what makes patent lawyers go apoplectic, because the whole point of the patent system is disclosure, is to actually incentivize companies in part not to go with trade secrets, but to actually disclose, you know, to get a patent and therefore publish their invention. I mentioned earlier, it's a requirement in the law that you actually have to clearly and distinctly describe your invention, and it has to be done in a way that someone who's skilled in that particular technological field can read it and know how to then make and use that invention. And then this patent when it issues, it's published and put into a public repository that is searchable on the internet now, you know, at the Patent and Trademark Office. And the whole reason for that is so that other people can immediately, the moment the patent is published, can read the patent and start working off of it and creating new innovation and creating competing products, perhaps. You know, a joke that I often sometimes say to people to make this point is that first there was, you know, Viagra, and then there was Cialis.
Yep.
and that's not an accident. Cialis followed on Viagra because you're able to read the patent on Viagra and understand, okay, now we know what they're doing. We'll come up with a different molecule that does the same thing. And they did. So those complaints are almost entirely theory-driven complaints. They're very rationalistic when you actually get into the actual arguments. And to the extent that they have data, it tends to be anecdotes. Or just very badly done, you know, empirical studies where very questionable collection of data.
So somebody on the chat here is mentioning somebody by the name of Michelle Boldrin. Are you familiar with Michelle Boldrin?
Yes. Yes.
Okay. So he claims
Boldrin and Levine are.
He has empirical arguments against patents that are not crap. The scholarly arguments, and I don't hear any concrete counter arguments from the patent side here. So you want to give a concrete counter argument to something Michelle Boldrin argues, if you remember?
Sure. So one of the things that Boldrin and Levine kind of primarily made them famous as their first kind of foray into doing intellectual property scholarship was they wrote a paper claiming that James Watt's patent on the steam engine impeded development and innovation in steam engine technology during the term of the patent through their as a result of their allegedly aggressive enforcement of their patent against competitors and copiers. I'm not going to go into all of the details of what they looked at, and I won't go into all the details. But then George Selgin, who's a highly regarded empirical economist,
yes.
Who's based at Cato, actually said, this is a really interesting argument. Let me go look at the actual historical data. And he actually went and looked at the data and found actually it's the exact opposite because Boldrin and Levine actually made some serious misrepresentations, either accidentally or intentionally, it's unclear, about the nature of British patent law at the time. Which was a required premise for them to argue about the impeding of innovation, that they characterized British patent law as being much more restrictive than actually it was, and he actually found problems with some of their data. I think Boldrin and Levine have done something similar in copyright, where they made some client arguments about how they made arguments about how British authors in the 19th century did not have their copyrights recognized in the United States. This goes back to my point about IP laws are domestic.
Yep.
And so there was extensive copying, unauthorized copying of British copyers' works in the United States. This was a real problem and a moral failing of our country at that time with respect to this issue. And there arose an argument that British copyers were actually compensated perfectly well, if not better, even though there wasn't recognition of their copyright in the 19th century. And this is often used as an argument that copyright's not necessary, and in fact, it impeded the ability in another context for people to get compensation for their copyrighted works. Stan Leibowitz, an economist at the University of Texas at Dallas, just recently went back and looked at the original data in the original sources and found that actually the exact opposite is true again, that actually British authors were not compensated at the same rates as American authors. It was actually pittance and studies that claim, you know, original claimed government studies that said otherwise. He found that actually what is often quoted is minority reports, not the majority
yep.
reports that are saying the
mm-hmm.
exact opposite and things of that sort. So it's just not true that they've done this kind of deep, rich scholarly analysis and that there's been no response. There's been tons of responses, and the responses continue to hit on the same theme, that the data does not support their claims.
And this is part of the problem of building a whole case on empirical evidence. I mean, we see this with so many things now. You've got to have a theory, and the theory has to be based on a sound epistemology and a sound you know, I think theoretical framework, a philosophical framework, particularly when you deal with legal issues like this. The philosophy of law is so crucial in setting up these things right, because empirics, I did empirical research. I am guilty of taking out certain outliers to get the result that I wanted. It's not hard. Empirical research is very, very messy. It's very easy to make mistakes. So it's not all about honesty. It's very easy to make mistakes. Econometrics is a deep, difficult science. Yes. Most people I've seen do econometrics treat it as if it's, oh, you take this group of data and that group of data and you run regressions. They have no clue what they're doing. Particularly, unfortunately, Austrian economists usually have no clue what they're doing with econometrics, but so they should stay away from it. But, you know, and this is, you can't ground it. Now, you've got it, once you have a theory, you need to test it, and empirical evidence is important, but to ground everything on empirical evidence is so, so dangerous, because it's so easy to distort and just make errors, just make mistakes.
Right. And I want to, and I also want to bring out a point that's implicit in what you're saying, also, which is that about the importance of thinking rationally in terms of being consistent in your methodology. Again, to treat intellectual property as suspect until intellectually proven as valid, in the sense that until you've shown through an empirical study causally that intellectual property definitely promotes innovation, definitely does this, you know, then we won't support it. If if libertarians embrace that standard for other property, for all other rights, including other property rights, then they couldn't be advocates for property rights in the land, because there's not a single empirical study that has been shown that that has directly causally linked property rights in land to economic growth. What you have is the exact same studies that that you have in IP, which is strong correlations along with other factors. Yeah,
and reality is so complex. There's so many variables. Mm-hmm. You know, we say when we do empirical studies, we say all things held constant, but nothing's ever held constant,
in
real life. So
right.
So empirical evidence is always messy. Now, again, that's not an excuse not to do empirical work, but it means that you have to ground it on solid, solid theoretical foundation and a rational methodology. All right, we got two more callers. Let's take them and then we'll see what we get. Hi, you're on the Yaron Brook Show. Who's this? 703 area code.
Abdullah.
Hey, Tom.
Hi, this is Tom. I'm calling from suburban Washington. I've been really concerned about all the recent appeal to emotion with regard to the EpiPen and other medicines that have, increased in price for whatever reason. And I know there are a lot of arguments against that, but what from a patent law perspective, or a patent rights perspective, how would you argue with these sort of, the soccer moms? I had to turn the television off because there were so many. You would be watching NBR or something, and they would start whining about how people weren't going to be able to afford it, and so people are going to die, et cetera. So why can't someone just go out? I'm playing devil's advocate here. Why can't someone just go out and produce the drug more cheaply and screw the owner of the patent?
Well, because the EpiPen case is a great case, because actually there's no patent here.
There's no patent.
There was a patent. There was a patent once, but EpiPen has been off patent for many, many years. And the reason why there's a monopoly here is nothing to do with the patent system. It has to do with the FDA.
Yep.
Is that the FDA prohibits anyone from coming up with a competing EpiPen without getting approval from the FDA. And the FDA keeps rejecting applications of people to bring to market competing epinephrine injection shots. It just rejected one last year from a very prominent pharmaceutical company. So this is actually great. I think this whole crisis over the EpiPen that arose is a great opportunity for us to actually teach people that this is not about patents, it's not about intellectual property. This is actually about you know, a regulatory state and the takeover, the government takeover of medical care in this country and medicine, that is what's causing these problems. And, you know, and we can really, you know, we have a rare moment here where we can really help educate people, I think, in a real way about what's the actual cause of some of these problems.
Absolutely. It's not just that it's the FDA not approving, alternatives to the EpiPen, and then plenty of companies with alternatives. There was one by, I think, a Swiss pharmaceutical that the FDA actually forced them off the market because they claimed that the dose was not exactly right. No harm, as far as we know, was caused to anybody, but they forced them off the market, not just to adjust, but off the market completely. But beyond that, why is EpiPen so expensive? It's not just that the company says, well, we've got a monopoly here, so we're going to exploit that monopoly by raising the price as far as we can get. That isn't a rational decision for a company to make. The real issue here is, who is the buyer of most EpiPens? Well, it turns out the buyer of most EpiPens is the government. Through Medicare and Medicaid, they are the ones that are purchasing most of these. And as a consequence, what do you have an incentive? If the government is buying anything from you, what are you going to do? You're going to jack up the price because the government doesn't care how much it pays for it. They're willing to pay astronomical amounts. And then what you do is you discount it for everybody else. So in reality, nobody pays, no private individual pays $500 for an EpiPen. It's only Medicare and Medicaid that pay $500 for EpiPens, right? So again, this whole is full of distortions because the company, in order to maximize a demand for its product, has discounted for private individuals and for insurance companies, but maxes its price up for government. So you get a list price, which the government pays, but nobody else pays. So the whole discussion is distorted by government, both on the FDA side and on the fact, you know, why are health costs go up? A large extent, health costs go up because government is the largest purchaser of health care in the world.
It's even a little more sordid than what you just described, because one of the reasons why the price has gone up is because the federal government passed a law a couple of years ago mandating that all schools provide EpiPens, and schools, of course, are public schools, they're public government, and they actually called it the EpiPen law. So they wrote the name, the trademark name of this particular delivery mechanism into the law. So every school, thinking, well, we want to be safe, to follow the law, so they just bought the EpiPens. And it's even a little more sordid than that, because actually the owner of Mylan, the manufacturer of EpiPen, is a daughter or daughter-in-law of one of the senators who wrote that law too. So again, this is a great story if we can tell about cronyism and government interference with the free market and the healthcare market.
All right. Thanks for the call. Appreciate it. Thanks for listening. We've got one more caller. Hi, you're on the Yvonne Brooks Show. Who's this?
Hi, this is Jennifer from Michigan.
Hey, Jennifer, how are you?
Fine, how are you?
Good,
I was calling because sometimes people will say, like, you know, cable signals or satellite signals, like for TV and stuff, people will somehow tap into that for free. They'll be able to get it, and they'll say, oh, well, once the signal's out in the air, it's floating out there so I can grab it and it's okay, and I'll tell them, no, you're stealing it. Because that signal belonged to someone, it was generated by someone, and they'll say, no, it's not. So I'm right, I assume, right?
Well, I mean, what the issue you're getting at is, again, is the issue that Yaron mentioned earlier about people are very concrete bound and physicalist when they come to think about property. And they think, if you're not literally grabbing something out of someone's hands or kicking down their front door, you're somehow not violating or infringing their property rights, and that's wrong morally, and it's wrong legally. And the law follows the moral theory here, which is that property, again, to go back to first principles, property is the right to use and control a material value that someone has created in order to live their life as a flourishing human in a society that flourishes with other people, and interference with the control and use of something and the profiting from it in the marketplace as a result of that is an interference with property rights. I mean, this is recognized in land as we talked about earlier, dresses and in other types of tangible, so-called tangible goods that are property rights in, exist in, as much as in intellectual property like spectrum and in inventions and books. Yes.
Yeah, it's amazing to me how many people I know that think that's okay, and I tell them, no, that's not okay. What if everybody did that? That place wouldn't even exist. They'd go out of business. I mean, not that that's the point, but I tell them, no, that's not right. But lots of people think, oh, that's okay, you know.
Yeah, but
right.
you see this. You see the same thing with like with music in the old days. I remember people justifying finding ways to justify copying cassettes because it was so easy. Once they issue the cassette, you know, and it's so easy. We have, and the same with you know digital media. If it's so easy to copy digital media, they put it out there, then we should have the right to copy it.
And and you see the exact same arguments in the 19th century. I mean, this is something. This is why I love doing historical research. It's really, you know, it grounds you in these in the facts and in the historical development of ideas and of doctrines and of things of that sort. And you know, in the 19th century, in the Industrial Revolution, you have the exact same arguments from the socialists at that time. Right now, you know. Industrialists are manufacturing like crazy, and there's all sorts of goods now that didn't exist before. So workers should be able to get them and should have a right to them.
Yeah.
Right.
Wrong.
So, yeah. You know, at every point in human history, when innovators and creators produce technology or new creative works that took us forward and created more abundance and more new values, there was always the people then saying, this changes everything, and we don't need property anymore.
All right. Great.
Thanks
for the call. Really appreciate it. Thanks for listening. So we got another question on the chat, I think another kind of these standard objections. And this is the argument. You must not conflate potential with the actual. Potential profits lost because someone copies a patent cannot justify using state coercion to, and you can see how the libertarian language filters through, to punish patent violators because the patent owner can still freely use his invention. So I'm not restricting you from using your invention. It's just that I'm copied it and I'm using your invention as well, is the argument.
Right. Right. And again, this goes back to the point that you made earlier about the kind of the physicalist assumption in libertarian critiques of intellectual property that would lead them actually to be opposed to lots of property rights, not just intellectual property, but property rights in land and things of that sort. Because again, you can make that argument about potential versus actual in every context in which someone interferes with someone else's use of their property, thereby depriving them of the fruits of their labors, the profits from their labors, or whatever other type of value they may be deriving from in exchange with others.
Yeah, but the argument they make is, let's say I have farmland. If you're using the farmland, I can't use the farmland, right? But the music in a copyright case, I mean, my copying and using that music, listening to it, does not deprive you of the ability to listen to the music. So it's duplicate, it's infinitely, you can duplicate it infinitely, whereas material goods cannot be duplicated in that way.
Right. And
like land.
Right. And so the premise of this critique is that it's scarcity, the economic concept of scarcity. It's the economic concept of what's known as rivalrous and exhaustion, which they loop together in this notion of scarcity, that there are scarce goods and we need property, therefore, to adjudicate disputes and to ensure that these scarce resources are used in appropriate ways. That's not the starting point for thinking about where property comes from and why we protect property. And this is what leads people down kind of to confused thinking that, therefore, copying of something is somehow in some fundamental moral way different than the interference with you know, enjoying the fruits of one's labors, ducks and things of that sort with land. But they're all, they all reflect the exact same principle of interfering with the control, use, disposition in the marketplace of the profit. You have a right to the values you've created and to engage in free trade with other people with the values you've created, given the nature of that value. And that value is different whether it's water or land or an invention. In each of those instances, the law has to protect the value in the only way possible that that value can be protected to its creator. And so what the value in an invention is that it is produced, manufactured, and copied, so to speak, and sales of those copies in the marketplace. This is one important difference between, but it's not a moral, it's not a point of moral difference in justification between patented invention, a property right in an invention, a property right in land, is that, yes, the property right in an invention is a prohibition on copying, and that, there is no copying of land. And this is one reason, as Ayn Rand explains in her short essay, why patents and copyrights are limited. Because they're rooted in what she calls dynamic value creation, not the exploitation of static value in a single tangible resource. And in fact, her explanation is very interesting because one of the economic justifications for intellectual property as an intellectual property system is a distinction in economics between what they call dynamic and static efficiency. And it's always been interesting to me that Ayn Rand actually predates that explanation.
Yep. Yeah, it's amazing.
By several decades, yeah.
So, yeah, I look. We are not utilitarians, so the justification of does not come from some idea of scarcity or, indeed, I don't think scarcity is a fundamental concept in economics at all. I think that's a wrong way of viewing economics. It's an invalid concept because all values are created. And here I'm on Julian Simon's side from the economics perspective rather than on most economists' side. Even good economists fall into the scarcity trap. But certainly when it comes to legal and moral philosophy, scarcity has no relevance. So Ayn Rand starts the essay on patents and copyrights by saying a man's right to the product of his own mind. That's what patents are protecting, a man's right to the product of his own mind. You have a right to the product of your own mind, whether it works economically or doesn't work economically. And it turns out, not accidentally, but it turns out that the moral is the practical is the moral, practical arguments are consistent with the moral arguments. But the starting point has to be the moral argument, and you have to recognize what it means to produce something, and that government is not using its coercive power to punish. That's not how you view patent laws. Government is there to protect the product of your mind. That is, the government is there to protect your rights. That's the perspective on government. The perspective on government is not it's as a punisher, but as a protector. That's the essential. It is there to protect.
And as a protector, a facilitator of the free market.
Yes.
And property rights are the foundation of the free market. This was one of the key insights that the United States had, the judges and legislators in the United States had, that we will make patents, we will recognize and secure the rights in patents and copyrights as property rights, not as government grants as they were in England, to special monopoly privileges granted by the crown. And as a result of that, they were able to go into the market and transact with them and commercialize and create contracts and create new different types of business models on the basis of these property rights. And it's the focus on the value creation and the positive role that property rights serve in protecting a creation and facilitating that person to then transact with other people with that property right. That's just the context is totally dropped when you think of patents merely as criminal law. Patents are not public criminal law; they are private law. They're a contract. They're property rights, like contract rights.
That's great. So I got one last question because this always comes up, and we don't have much time. So if you can give a short answer to it, it's a complicated question, we have to move on to a different topic. But the whole issue of the duration of intellectual property rights always comes up. Isn't this just subjective? Isn't this just arbitrary? What's the objective? What's the objective defense of duration? Now, we know they can be perpetual, but how do we know if it's 5 years, 7 years, 20 years, 25 years? Isn't that just arbitrary?
Yes. Great question. It's a complex issue. This is the actual issue that Iran said is very complex in her essay.
Yep.
I actually have a whole talk on it that I gave at an OCON a couple years ago.
It's on YouTube, right?
Yeah, I think you can listen to it or download it for free.
Yep.
So the fundamental point is to recognize is that what our principles tell us is that you should protect it, and you need to protect it for the time that is required for the owner to reap the benefits of their value creation. And this applies just as much in, you know, for other property rights and contracts and things as it does for intellectual property. So our principles, we can't deduce from our principles. Ergo, the only rational time for a patent term is 20 years. And if we can't do that, if we can't figure that out, then it's unjustified. Because the fact of the matter is that you could say the exact same thing about, criminal sentences, right? Someone has violated someone's rights. They've murdered someone. How do we know that 25 years is the appropriate prison term for punishing someone who has violated someone's rights?
Never thought of that one, yeah.
You can't deduce that. You know, it could be 30, it could be 20. Well, what our principles tell us is there's a range that we have to fall within. You know, for patents, it can't be 6 months, and it can't be 100 years. And then as Ayn Rand identifies, you take into account things like the nature of the technology and things and other issues to try to come, you know, to try to settle on for rule of law purposes a particular time. But, you know, you could, even outside of the context of, you know, criminal law, you could say, you know, why do we say people can drive at 16? Because, you know, a rational kid could potentially be capable of driving at 12, and
yep.
Some couldn't drive until they're 20. So why have we arbitrarily chosen 16? The law is totally invalid on this,
yep.
You know, setting aside, you know, that there should be driver's laws or not. But the point is that because the law has to pick for rule of law purposes, for notification that people know and people can then therefore create contracts and things of that sort and order their lives, they have to pick some type of specified term, specified
yep.
date. And that's why we don't demand in the law or in any other area of the law that we have to therefore rationally justify a specific time period, and we shouldn't in IP either. It's just that it has to be for a reasonable enough a period of time. And I think patents probably right now are too short at 20 years. Copyright might be, you know, too long,
probably
at
too long.
Life
yeah.
plus 70. But
yeah.
you know, for when you talk to people in the creative industries, they think the term
yep.
debate is a red herring. They, you know,
yep.
as I said earlier, for them, you know, the reality of the term is 30 seconds.
Yep. All right, great. Adam, thank you. Really appreciate this. Great discussion. And hopefully you guys listening learned a lot about intellectual property rights. We'd love to have you back on I'm sure there'll be other questions and we can discuss them. I encourage everybody, a couple of things. One, go pick up Capitalism, the Unknown Ideal and read Ayn Rand's short but really illuminating essay on patents and copyrights, which is one of the essays in Capitalism, the Unknown Ideal. And then follow Adam. Adam has a website for his center, for the Center for the Protection of Intellectual Property. He has a lot of videos on YouTube and other places. So if you're interested in this topic, Adam's the guy to follow and to read his stuff. So engage in Adam Ossoff's material. Thank you.
Well, thank you. This was awesome.
Good.
Thank you, Ron.
We'll talk soon. Thanks, Adam.
Yes, sure.
All right. We're going to take a short break. And when we get back, we're going to be talking to the director of a new movie, a new documentary called The Money Changers, in which I have a small role. And which is going to start screening all over the country in a couple of weeks, and which is also based on somewhat based on an essay that I wrote years ago. And Chris Mortensen is going to join us, which I'm excited about. You might remember Chris because he also was the director of the Atlas Shrugged documentary from a few years back. So we're going to take this short break, and then we're going to get Chris on the line to talk about the documentary.
Ayn Rand was a radical thinker whose philosophical novels challenged students to reconsider their views on fundamental issues. The Fountainhead, Atlas Shrugged, and Anthem. These works have become classics of American literature that never fail to engage young people and stimulate intense classroom discussion. By offering these works for free to teachers, the Ayn Rand Institute hopes to encourage greater awareness and understanding of Rand's stimulating perspective. If you're a teacher who would like Ayn Rand's books in your classroom, visit AynRand.org. This is at no cost to you. Go to AynRand.org today.
When The Fountainhead was first published more than 70 years ago, Ayn Rand's bold literary vision and groundbreaking philosophy of individualism captured the world's attention. Initially rejected by 12 publishers as too intellectual, the novel became an instant classic and continues to provoke heated debates. What motivates a creative thinker? Is it a selfless desire to benefit mankind, a hunger for fame, fortune, and accolades, the need to prove superiority, or is it a self-sufficient drive to pursue a creative vision independent of others' needs or opinions? Ayn Rand addresses these questions through her portrayal of Howard Roark, an innovative architect who, as she puts, struggles for the integrity of his creative work against every form of social opposition. It's also the story of his love affair with a woman who seeks to defeat him. The Fountainhead is as relevant today as it was when Rand first penned it. The novel was also a personal landmark for Rand. In Howard Roark, she presented for the first time the uniquely Ayn Rand hero, man as he could be and ought to be. Order your copy today in Amazon.com.
You didn't build that. You don't pay your fair share. Who do you think you are? Ayn Rand knew exactly who you are. Rational, productive, independent. You work hard and use your own judgment. You choose your career path, your lifestyle, your values. You're living the American dream. And now you see that there are people who want to take away what you've created and who will call their lust to loot a virtue. People who think the needs of others is a claim on your money, your work, your life. Well, how can you fight back? That's what they do at the Ayn Rand Institute. They look closely at public policy beyond sound bites and election cycles, at the fundamental moral ideas that frame crucial debates. They focus on reframing the issues in line with reason, egoism, and individual rights to life, liberty, property, and the pursuit of happiness. Your life, liberty, property, and the pursuit of your happiness. Stand up with them to fight against the sacrifice of your values by making a contribution today at AynRand.org/support. They'll use your money to defend your values.
How does economic inequality emerge in a free society? From a bunch of win-win transactions. When J.K. Rowling wrote her Harry Potter books, she created something of value. Seven great stories for which millions of people willingly and happily paid $10 or even $20 apiece. Now, what happened to inequality as a result? It grew. Rowling became a billionaire, starting from poverty, while her fans saw their income stay the same and their wealth go down by a tiny amount, that same $10 or $20 per book. Income inequality grew, but everyone was better off as a result. Everyone won through these win-win exchanges. That's the way inequality arises under freedom, and that's why it should. For more on inequality, see the new book by Yaron Brook and Don Watkins, Equal is Unfair, America's Misguided Fight Against Income Inequality, out in bookstores everywhere on March 29th. For more information, go to equalisunfair.com. That's equalisunfair.com.
All right. So as you know, I devote the final segment of all of my shows to, or try to anyway, to a positive value, to something in the arts that is positive. This is not quite art, but it is documentary, and it's very positive. And we've got Chris. I think we've got Chris on the line. Hey, Chris, are you on the line?
Yeah, can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear the rest of New York in the background as well.
Yes, you can. I'm sitting in the lobby of the Hilton Hotel on 6th because there's 2,700 people waiting in line to get into the room. So can you hear me all right, though?
Yeah, we can hear you fine. So Chris, as many of you probably know, was the director and the producer of Ayn Rand and the Prophecy of Atlas Shrugged, which you can see on Netflix and I think on some other of the online on the online streaming services. But, you know, I encourage everybody who's interested in Atlas Shrugged to go and watch the documentary if you haven't yet. But he has a new movie out, which, again, I'm involved in, called The Money Changes. So, Chris, tell us a little bit about the movie and then where people can see it. Well, we'll get to where people can see it and how they can order screenings. Go ahead.
Sure. We call The Money Changers. It's the documentary that God and Washington don't want you to see. Actually, the banking documentary that God and Washington don't want you to see. And there's two good reasons for that. One is that I directed it, and the second one is that you're in it.
Yeah, so, that was a God and Washington right there.
God and Washington. Exactly. Now, it's after the, Yaron wrote this wonderful essay some years ago, and a lot of people really liked it and thought it was prescient, and And we talked about it and thought it might make a good basis for a documentary about, because people have a lot of misconceptions about not only what happened in the financial crisis, but about banking and money lending in general. And so this was an opportunity, we thought, to clear the air and like discuss it and not, you know, examine the subject. And you know, I keep going back to this. I did a show years ago where it was a two-hour special on wrestling, and it was on professional wrestling, and it was an assignment I got from the A&E Network. And the thing was, well, you know, you're doing a show about wrestling, and, you know, well, what am I going to say? You know, that wrestling's fake? Well, who doesn't know that, you know? So we started with, I said, okay, well, that's got to be the concept. Wrestling is fake. Well, then the question is, why does anybody watch it? You know, what are you getting out of this? And so then the question became, well, when did it start being fake? Or was it ever really real to begin with? And, you know, I know this is a stretch, but I sort of had the same challenge with the money changers. The idea that so many people think the financial system that we have is rigged, and they want to know, well, you know, 2008 comes along and nobody goes to jail. Well, isn't that interesting? You know, someone ran off with all the money. The treasury was looted. And so who are the bad guys here? So, you know, and it's not that. So, okay, let's just say, let's leave it like that. And let's go back and address it like the rest of the show and say, all right, is the system rigged? And, you know, if it is rigged, when did it start being rigged? Or was it always this way? Have we always been faced with this, a system like this? And when I mean the system, I'm talking about the relationship between government and banking and finance. And so we went back through time. We went back to the Bible. That's why we have the Lie About God, you know, because it starts I guess it's the altruism that's called for in the Bible. And we took it back to the moneylenders of the early moneylenders, the Jewish moneylenders, who were not allowed to make interest from anybody except, you know, they couldn't.
Well, they weren't. God says to the Jews, you're not allowed to charge interest from your brother. And the Jews say, okay, well, that means I can't charge interest from other Jews, but I can charge interest from non-Jews.
Right.
And that starts them on a path that leads to a lot of trouble, a lot of good and a lot of trouble for them. And of course, Christians take brother to mean everybody. So Christians cannot borrow and lend money at interest. Now, I'm not going to give the whole movie away, but that's a big part of the beginning of the movie in terms of describing the history of it and what actually goes on. It's really noisy there, Chris.
I'm sorry. It's like I found a corner. I'm hiding behind a philodendron around the corner here.
Okay. Well, try to yell into the mic of the phone. So let's get some of the practical stuff on, and then I'm going to let you go, and then I'm going to talk a little bit more about the movie. Tell us about
good.
The screenings, where they're going to be, and what most importantly, if somebody's interested in hosting a screening, what can they do in order to achieve that?
Okay, we have a website that's it's moneychangersfilm.com, and on it you can see what our upcoming screenings are. And we're starting off September 14th in San Francisco. The next night we're in Dallas. Now, these are event screenings. These are not like general screenings. We call them event screenings because there'll be guests from the films there. We're going to have a lot of great people doing a Q&A on a panel with the film. The film runs about an hour and a half, and then we'll have a half-hour panel afterward. So on the 13th of September, we're in San Francisco. The 14th of September.
Okay.
Then the next, I can hardly hear myself think.
Yeah, no, I, you know what? I can do this because I got the list right in front of me and I can tell people about it. And if somebody wants to host the screening, are there ways on the website to let you know that they'd like to host the screening?
I believe so. It probably links to the Tug website, which is a distributor, that's doing hostess screenings. But the best thing to do is contact us through info@moneychangersfilm.com, and we can set you up, give you information on the existing screenings that are coming up in September. There's one every week and a couple of them in a row. And then in October, we'll be doing some more. So we'll have information on all that.
Good.
And then if anybody wants to host a screening in a smaller venue, because these are like movie theaters. These are, look at moneychangersfilm.com.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks, Chris. I'm gonna mute you. All right. That's better. Sorry, Chris. But let me talk a little bit about the movie, because I think you'll be impressed by the people being interviewed in the movie. We've got John Allison, we've got Charles Calamaris, who's a finance professor at Columbia University and is a world expert on kind of the history of banking, particularly in the U.S., but also internationally. Then we've got two. A former chairman of the FDIC, one chief financial officer from the FDIC, former. And it's amazing what these guys say. It's just stunning. I never thought I'd hear people from the FDIC actually admit to the things that these guys admit to. We've got, I think, one of the best parts in the whole movie is towards the end when we talk about the financial crisis and we get a commentary from Richard Kovacevic. I think I got their name right. I apologize if not, who is the retired chairman and CEO of Wells Fargo. And he tells in the movie a footage that I've never seen before. He says what exactly happened in the meetings with Paulson and Bernanke when they were forced to accept TARP. And it's stunning. The level of fascism, if you will, the level of coercion, the level of government imposition of their will on these bankers, the explicit nature of it, it really is unbelievable. The former chief executive of the Federal Reserve of St. Louis. We've got George Selgin, the economist, Peter Wallison, who is a world expert on the housing crisis and everything housing, including Fannie and Freddie, is in the documentary. You've got Todd Zawicki, who is a professor of law, also from George Mason, like Adam Ossoff. But his specialty is consumer finance. So he talks about consumer finance historically, but also in the context of the financial crisis and in the context of the regulations that are going on right now. So an amazing lineup of people being interviewed and a great arc of a story, because it really does start with history, with the kind of the biblical, what God tells the Jews about money lending. It also discusses Aristotle's view of money lending, which is not positive, by the way, and therefore the Catholic view, which kind of embraced Aristotle on this, and the Catholic view really going into the 19th century, and then how money and banking evolve and how linked at the hip they have been from almost the beginning to government, because government identified the power that they could gain from being linked at the hip with money and with banking. And the whole evolution of that into America. Did America ever have a free banking system? No, it turns out it's never been completely free. And the consequence in things like the Great Depression, the SNL crisis, and the financial crisis, some of the best content in the financial documentary. Now, one of Chris's innovations is that he creates a narration throughout, and the narration is done by a character, an actor, who is portraying, if you will, a modern version of Shylock. Shylock, of course, the character from Shakespeare's Merchant of Venice, which is the Merchant of Venice in itself, a play, which is a great illustration of the attitude that people held when Shakespeare was writing and before Shakespeare and today, towards bankers, moneylenders, the whole field of finance. So a fun movie, a very educational movie. You'll learn a lot. And let me just give you some of the dates and some of the places where it's screening. So as we said, the first screening is September 14th in San Francisco. It's at 6:30, and you can get all this information. You can get all this information on moneychangersfilm.com. So September 14th. Now, we want these theaters to be full. We need you to show up, because that'll kind of help perpetuate the movie. That'll help convince Netflix that this is a movie worth purchasing. That'll create more people sponsoring and asking for the movie to be screened. So we want to have full theaters. Now, in addition to that, we've also got at the end of each showing Q&A. So, for example, in San Francisco, the Q&A will include me, Stephen Haber, who is a professor at Stanford, and this is a real treat. You'll get Richard Kovacevic, the retired chairman and CEO of Wells Fargo, will also be there, and Chris Mortensen, the director, will be at all of these. So the one in San Francisco, strongly encourage you to show up because it's going to have just some, you know, just to see Kovacevic talk about the financial crisis. I would fly to San Francisco just for that because it's so cool. So that's September 14th. September 15th is going to be in Dallas. All you Texans, you got to show up for this and bring your friends. And again, you can sign up online. You can buy tickets online. And I'm hoping you bring friends. So it's in Dallas. And right now the guest speakers are just me and Chris. But you know what? You're going to get a lot of me. Chris, not so much. But me, right, because I'm not going to let speak that much, which is worth the price of admission just to come and hear me speak about finance. On September 19th, we're going to be in Florida. And again, it's going to be me and Chris, probably some other people, but for now, just me and Chris. So all of these, the guest lists are going to be changing. So September 15th, Dallas, September 19th in Florida, in Southern Florida, Hialeah, I don't know what that means. I don't know where that is. It's somewhere in Southern Florida near Miami. It's some name of a town that I can't even pronounce. All right, September 26th, New York City. And we got a great lineup of speakers here. We got Charles Kalamaras, one of the best financial thinkers out there, financial historians out there in the world. I've known Charles Kalamaras I've been reading his stuff for over 20 years. His book on the American banking system is excellent. So I'd highly recommend just to come and hear Charles is worth it. But I'll also be there. Me too. So Charles Kalamaras, Josh Rosner, who's a managing director of the Independent Research Consortium, which is, I guess it's a financial research consortium. Christopher Whalen, who's a senior manager director of the Financial Institutions Rating Group. So this is a private rating group. And then we've got Chris, of course. So Chris, me, Kalamaras, Rosner, and Whalen. Great. By the way, the Florida one, I just got a text, is near the airport. So near the airport, Miami airport. All right. And finally for September, but we really need you guys to show up in September. So I'm really hoping that you will come. The final one in September is at the Landmark Ritz at the Bourse in Philadelphia. So Philadelphia, we want it sold out. Bring students, bring financiers, bring bankers. Bring anybody you can think of who is going to be interested in this. So, and bring people who disagree. Bring people who don't know anything about the financial crisis, don't know anything about banking. They'll benefit enormously. So September 28th in Philadelphia, right? Now, we'll have dates in October, November, but I am not going to be speaking probably in the October ones because I'm going to be in Europe. So if you want to hear my commentary on the film, you've got to come on these September dates, 14th in San Francisco, 15th in Dallas, 19th in Florida, Southern Florida, 26th in New York City, and 28th in Philadelphia. Great speakers, great panels afterwards. I think you'll enjoy the movie. I think you'll find it entertaining and educational as well. Bring your friends, bring people, and go sign up now. Register in advance so we have all this registered. But it's really, really important that we sell out the September dates and that we get large audiences in those for those September dates. So, I'm excited. And let me just say, I don't even think Chris knows about this. But in some respects, this movie is going to be a launch of a major project for me and for my co-author, Don Watkins. I think over the next 2 years, we are going to be putting out literature that is basically focused on this question, on all the questions that Money Changers brings up. So we are already planning a book on the morality of finance that will come out sometime next year. Our guess is that that'll be a first in a series of books and pamphlets and articles. that are going to be basically, we want to do for the financial industry, in a sense, what Alex Epstein has done for the oil and gas industry. We want to be the bodyguards, the defenders, the philosophical protectors of banks and the financial industry. And this movie is a first in a whole series of products and events and everything else that that we're going to be producing over the next few years. So show your support for this project. Come watch the Money Changers movie. I hope to see all of you guys there. Thanks for listening to Yaron Brooks Show. As always, in my AM560 show in about an hour, you can listen to me interviewing Amish, and I'm not going to pronounce his family name right now, Amish, about the Zika virus and what's going on in Miami and the science of it and all of that. So stay tuned. But for now, you've been listening to Yaron Brooks Show. Talk to you next week, same time, same place. Thank you all. Thanks, Chris. And particularly thank Adam Ossoff for spending over an hour with us to talk about IP.